the number one thing that we are thinking when we think about sustainability is how do we get more people into congregations? That's a question I get at the Hysterical Society. How many people join congregations because of the Hysterical Society? And when you're talking about people who are adjacent to UUism, our funding model has nothing to do with getting people into congregations.
Welcome back to UU Expressions Love in Real Life, a 10-episode docu-series that discovers, celebrates, and challenges how Unitarian Universalism is practiced across Canada in 2024. In this episode, we have a conversation about money as it relates to community-based ministries and the assets managed by UUs and beliefs and systems around it. That was Liz James, by the way, from Mirth and Dignity, sharing her perspective on generating revenue. I'm Amber Belmar.
And I'm Erin Horvath. And yes, money is a theme that emerged from our UU Expressions research, and not just with those doing community-based ministry. So much so that we're setting aside a whole episode to discuss it.
Community-based ministry could look like a social service, such as a shelter. It could look like social enterprise, such as a cafe or bike shop. It could look like outreach, such as the work lay chaplains do, or even community partnerships, such as low-income or Indigenous housing projects.
Yes, so for our purposes, community-based ministry is an umbrella term to refer to anything that isn't congregationally focused.
Now, when it comes to money, in some cases, people said there wasn't enough of it. For instance, as congregation sizes decrease, some groups are debating whether they have the finances to support a minister and or a building.
In other cases, people were cautious, almost like they feared that it could corrupt the intention of their ministry in some way. For instance, some feared money could be a barrier to inclusion in UU groups, workshops, and events, or that charging more money to cover the cost of upgrading a person's experience may be a barrier to inclusion, such as charging higher camper fees to provide better facilities, or charging more for youth and young adult events so that more nutritious food could be served.
Sometimes the discussion revolved around who gets to decide if an initiative is worthwhile, such as in the case of submitting grants to receive funding.
And other times, the context was around succession planning, what to do with finances and assets that are outliving the UU group that has been stewarding them for years.
A huge topic. Before we get too deep, let's set the scene in terms of understanding the financial interconnections that exist between different UU expressions so we can understand more about how money is flowing.
If there's one thing I've learned from these interviews, it's that not all parts of the UU ecosystem in Canada are aware of the circumstances each of its parts are experiencing and the impact that it's having on the whole. And without this knowledge, it's difficult for people to respond in a proactive and conscious way.
There was a time when Canadian society was at a different stage of its evolution and UU congregations were thriving. This was partly due to the way the household was run, with one person working a 9-to-5 job that could generate enough income to sustain the family's needs. This meant that one or more members of a UU household could volunteer to keep aspects of the congregation operating. With the financial contributions of members in each congregation, a building was purchased and cared for, a minister and staff salaries were paid, social justice initiatives, youth and young adult programs were funded, and annual contributions were paid to the Canadian Unitarian Council, who provided and continues to provide support services to member congregations.
Nowadays, as members age, congregational membership nationwide continues to decline, which means the funds raised in each congregation are decreasing. This impacts each of the areas described. We have some groups that are unable to financially afford to exist in the same way and are making decisions about which things to do without.
At the same time, we have a passionate group of young adults rising up nationally using online platforms. The financial investment to youth and young adult programming is critical to the longevity of UUism in Canada. However, the costs are not being replenished by the young adult membership. In fact, now more than ever, young adults are requesting financial sponsorship in order to participate in events. Why is this? Unlike their parents and grandparents, these young adults are living in a gig economy where many of them work multiple jobs to make ends meet and are not reaching milestones of adulthood at the same pace their parents did. Like, for instance, moving out, getting a full-time job, buying a home. And while some are a part of a congregation, many are not. They are telling us their financial situation is such that they are not making donations to their local or national UU bodies.
So to be clear, the bulk of the financial responsibility of sustaining UUism in Canada is falling on the diminishing number of aging UUs.
So within this context, we have a variety of community-based ministries largely existing through small grants, donations from participants, and at times participant fees. And just to note that most participant fees now run at a sliding scale, with zero being acceptable, and a trend that most people opt for the lower end of the scale.
And now within this mix, Mirth and Dignity has been playing a role in helping some people and groups navigate the world of writing small grants to access funds. Here is Wendy Luella Perkins from Soulful Singing explaining the role Liz James and Andrea James of Mirth and Dignity played in helping her secure the grant she received from the Unitarian Universalist Association to start an online database of her songs for purchase.
I couldn't just make an individual request. I needed to be part of a different body to be able to do that. And Mirth and Dignity came forward and we co-wrote the grant. Like, we worked a full day on writing the grant. Of course, it's what I wanted to do, but they really helped me with so many different things. It's just beautiful. So that was a really tangible, extremely supportive kind of connection where Mirth and Dignity saw what I was doing, saw the value in it, then said, we want to amplify this. We have no ways to get funding for these kind of things. We will support you for imagining the project, writing the grant in a way that's going to be more likely to be successful, being the sponsorship organization. So that's all super. They also will manage the financial part. So they'll get the check, they'll distribute the money, all in ways that are so supportive to me. Having written grants before and then had to manage the whole thing and all that as an individual, that's a lot. It's also feeling that, you know, when you can lean back and go, there's somebody else here that's holding this with me, which is very different than doing your own project on your own.
As we see in this example, many grants will not receive applications from individual people, which is a definite barrier for community-based ministers like Wendy Luella. Thankfully, in this case, Mirth and Dignity were generous to offer their organizational structure as the sponsoring organization and their guidance with writing the grant. However, this isn't necessarily sustainable if UUism were to see an increase in community-based ministries, as all of this labor was offered voluntarily and was manageable because it was a single initiative.
It is a useful reference point to demonstrate the type of support that could be provided if we want to remove barriers to full inclusion and freedom of expression to our community-based ministers and groups that are not already associated with a congregation.
And even for those with associations to congregations, there are unique ongoing supports that community-based ministries would benefit from that congregational bodies may not be familiar with. Wendy Luella emphasizes that the current structure of UUism in Canada is set up to engage with congregations who are recognized as the formal member associations of the CUC and not necessarily groups which are outside of that definition. But she feels that we have come by this honestly, given our shared history.
When people had big families, and this is very binary, but mothers and fathers went to work and mothers stayed home with the children. When you look at the 40s, 50s, and 60s, when that was the norm, you had REs filled with children and congregations filled and communities that could seat 500, 600, 700 filled because it met that need at that time. And then things have changed fundamentally since the 50s. And that yet our congregations still kind of look a lot like they did in the 50s. So you raise something in what you talked about with the CUC bylaws. It serves congregations. And I know this is a challenge. Someone who is an entrepreneurial minister or a community-based minister, I get paid because people who receive the services that I offer pay me. With soulful singing, maybe 60% of the people that come to soulful singing give me money for that. Probably 40% don't. And I would say of that 40%, the vast majority of those people are living in poverty. I know that the ministry that I do serves folks who are living on ODSP, or they're on Ontario Works, or they have a disability, or they're retired on a fixed income. And so there are quite a number of people that I know, if they had to pay for this, if they were like, I'm going to a singing group and it's this much, they would not be able to come. I've always offered all of my things with a sliding scale, which zero is a legitimate offering. And zero isn't zero, because in soulful singing, you're talking about the aliveness that is part of our youth culture. And I think the aliveness of part of soulful singing is that we're all participating.
Sounds like on point of, you know, relationalness, right? It's all connected. So if they give money to you, it's because they know that money is what you use to sustain life when it comes to housing and food and energy bills and transportation and what have you. So it's not just about the maintaining of a building or giving a tithing type donation or whatever it is, right? There is a personal connection there. I'm curious, is this the way that you make a living, or do you have other things that you have to do or do to supplement?
It is mostly now the way that I make a living. I actually left my job at Queen's for a variety of reasons. I do an occasional wedding or memorial service and a little bit of other work. I have a partner. He's retired. We have income from him as well. If that didn't exist, I would not be able to live on my own with the level of income I make.
So here we're seeing another instance where something is able to happen because there is a considerable amount of volunteer time. However, Wendy Luella's ministry is not yet paying a living wage.
Right. And as she shared with me, she's able to volunteer this time because she has a partner whose retirement income contributes significantly to maintaining their shared household. In terms of considering long-term sustainability, however, I'm reminded of the comment from one of our interviewees who lives below the poverty line that volunteering is a privilege for those who have their basic needs met.
So in terms of removing barriers to full inclusion, it seems there's work to do to support community-based ministries. If our movement depends only on those with enough privilege to volunteer, we are in trouble. As soon as life circumstances change and they can no longer volunteer their time, that ministry may not be able to continue.
Yes, and to expand this notion further, imagine if community-based ministries were thriving so much that they could afford to create good jobs for people, providing local alternatives to the economy that many people, including UU young adults, have been lamenting.
That would be ideal and certainly on brand for UUs. A good topic for further reflection could be, what role could each of us and the national community be playing in supporting community-based ministers and or ministries? What is the relationship of community ministers to UMOC, the Unitarian Universalist Ministers of Canada, and the CUC? Are there additional pathways to membership and support services? And then potentially local congregations and UU groups, or something else entirely, as in the case of an online ministry that is not defined by geographic boundaries.
Conversation about how UUs could approach things differently was interwoven into several of the interviews. Let's hear from Keoki White Duck at the Ajashki Project at First Unitarian Congregation of Ottawa. In talking with Ajashki, I learned that this project is also precarious, depending on grants, donations from Ottawa First, and volunteers at the moment. There's ways of generating funds that use business models that then also give you a secure base of customers. So it carries through, right? So you're not just pooling random people to say, hey, do you want to support my ministry?
I understand that we live in this system that privileges the bottom line. That's the system we currently live in. That is not the system I want for the future. I know myself, like even as you're talking about business models, and part of me, there is a resistance for me, which is like, oh my gosh, I have to buy into a system that I actually don't believe in to have a sustainable ministry. There is an existential kind of grief about that, an angst about that in a certain kind of a way.
I've heard this, and one of my growing edges in life is to understand money as energy. It's just another form of energy,
yeah.
And that things can become sustainable in a variety of different ways, and that there's an opportunity to put, when you said give money to meaning, I would also say give meaning to money.
Mm-hmm.
And let's claim that back, because money is being harnessed and used for a lot of destructive things in the world. And that there's, in my view, a wonderful thing that happens when money becomes an energy that flows, that moves, and that systems are allowed to do that. And so then it doesn't become an issue of selling out, like wherein that something becomes financially sustainable. We go, oh my gosh, am I now corrupt? Have I done the wrong thing, right? And so there's something there to be understood. I've operated New Vision Unlimited since 2006, always on a social enterprise model, mm-hmm. and also had the ability to use sliding scale. And somehow, right, because that we're holding the values as the center,
mm-hmm.
that we then use money in a way that is transformative, that's engaging, that brings life, and that allows things to be sustainable regardless of what the powers that be think. And that, I think, is what's really important, because when we are at the mercy of begging people for money, then those who are being begged to have an upper hand. And this happens the most probably in charitable exchanges, where somebody literally can say, I don't grant you the ability to exist because I won't give you the money to do it.
Right.
And so part of becoming financially sustainable, in my view, is that it removes some of those. Whether it's a government that gives money or it's a wealthy person that gives money, there's still an inability for people to do what they want to do, what their heart and their soul is calling them to do, if there isn't a way for money to move that doesn't require someone else to say, I christen you or I don't.
It does create these dependencies all over the place, for sure. Yeah. And I think it's beautiful what you said too. And that's the intellectual versus the really embodied understanding that I do see money as energy and I still have blocks.
I really appreciated Wendy Luella's introspection here and her willingness to name what resistance comes up in her. She is certainly not alone in this feeling, as it appeared in several interviews in one way or another.
Me too. The apprehension is evident here, as though setting up a ministry that involves an exchange of money outside of donations within churches would mean buying into something that goes against UU values.
Right, as though churches currently operate outside the system.
Maybe we need to be explicit here. What is meant by the system?
Now, that's a great question. Let's break it down. Pulling from the Oxford Dictionary and Wikipedia, a system is a group of related things that work together as a whole. These things can be real or imaginary. Systems can be human-made things like a car engine or human societies, or natural things like a star system or ecosystem. Systems can also be concepts made by people to organize ideas.
Okay, so in this case, the system is referring to the social system, the way our society operates.
Right, and the Canadian social system is made up of components that interrelate, including economy, health, education, protection, infrastructure, religion, charity, food production, laws and governance. Essentially, all the components of human relating. We are born into this system, domesticated to it, and it will endure past any of our individual lifespans.
So it's rather interesting to imagine that setting up a ministry where money is exchanged would suddenly result in participating within the system, because we are, in fact, already within the system, as Wendy Luella acknowledged.
Right. Religion and economy are interwoven within the system, just like all other aspects are as well. The most obvious evidence of this is that our current ministers working in the congregational settings, which many UUs are familiar with, receive money for their work from the people who attend their congregation. Those people get their money from the jobs they do within the system. Whether they're construction workers, medical professionals, teachers, business owners, artists, or whatever it is, they get their money by participating in the system. Also, under Canadian tax law, religious institutions qualify as charities, which gives them certain tax shelters within the system. They can also qualify for grant money, which can come from government taxes or donations from private citizens or foundations. There's no way around it. UUism is already integrated within the system.
So does that mean we are already corrupt?
Well, I mean, personally, I don't see things in those terms. I think it's more about recognition of the interrelated nature of all things. We exist within a co-created society. not above it or outside it, but within it.
Yeah, this makes me think of our seventh UU principle, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part.
Exactly. We might first think of the ecosystem when we hear that principle, but it also includes the human-created systems. There's a wonderful book called Getting to Maybe, How the World Has Changed by Frances Wesley, Brenda Zimmerman, and Michael Patton. It's one of my personal favorites. These authors draw the parallel between natural ecosystems and human-created system, emphasizing that no matter which angle you consider it, we are all beings of the system. They go on to say, we don't stand outside the complex system we are trying to change. When it changes, we do. When we change, it does. Other change experts like Gregory Bateson point out that while we may disagree with the system, we each play a role in sustaining it until we feel called to change it. Now, the good news in all of this is that we can shape the system just by shaping ourselves because we're connected to it. It shapes us, sure, and we shape it. In fact, there are specific terms and strategies that social entrepreneurs take to enact systems-based change, which could be exciting to delve into in more detail sometime.
Okay, so I'll have to add that to my reading list. Okay, so what does it mean for our consideration of UU community-based ministries?
Likely the full answer will come from UUs asking themselves that question, but what I can offer is this. Instead of shying away, lean into it with consciousness and intentionality and begin shifting that system.
Which could really open the ways we bring our UU values into the world.
Conversation about how UUs could approach things differently was interwoven into several of the interviews. Let's hear from Keoki White Duck at the Ajashki Project at Ottawa First Unitarian Fellowship. In talking with Ajashki, I learned that this project is also precarious, meaning it's depending on grants and donations from Ottawa First and volunteers at the moment.
All the volunteers are pretty much all non-Indigenous people, and we really appreciate them. All of our youth participants are paid a livable wage for Ottawa. That's pretty much almost all funded through grants, and the rest of it comes from donations from donors who give monthly. Also comes from the grants and the donors. We all struggle with getting enough funding. Sometimes we're doing better than others, but yeah, as of right now, we have enough for a couple more months. We've applied for some grants, so hopefully we get that. But if we do not get any more grants, eventually our funding will run out. We also do get a lot of in-kind contributions from First U, allowed us to operate the way we've been operating.
Keoki explained the challenges Ajashki has because the lead organization is not Indigenous.
We applied for Indigenous funding. First, we got successful, but then they realized, oh no, you're not an Indigenous organization. And with certain Indigenous funds, they need an Indigenous-run organization to be able to actually accept the funds. And since First U oversee all our financial, or not oversee, they help us with all our finances. And so they weren't able to accept the money on behalf of Ajashki. So we actually went to external organizations that are Indigenous to help us out with any Indigenous funding. And we were successful in that.
And Lynn Kaufmel Preston, who's a part of Ajashki's Circle of Support volunteers, explains how relying on grants impacts their ability to take action as they would like.
Last winter, we were able to do an art project, which was driven by the Puutu Warriors in terms of the format. But we were able to do that because we had the money for an arts grant and an arts project. So to some degree, the money that we receive allows us to do certain things, and then also restricts us in certain things because we don't have consistent funding.
Okay, so there are a few things to unpack here. Earlier, we talked about how everything in the system is interconnected. What we didn't speak about, but is understood by many UUs, is that certain types of people within the system have more power and others have less, based on their characteristics, like race or religion, gender, sexual orientation, disability, class, relationship or family configuration, education, and various other factors.
This system we have here in Canada is a colonial system, which means it has been imposed on this land by outsiders from Europe with the intent of taking over Indigenous land and lives. Their agenda continues to this day, and everyone alive today has inherited this legacy.
Within this system, there are efforts happening to try to correct imbalances related to settler-Indigenous relations, which Ajashki seems to have run headlong into. Specifically, I'm referring to the roadblock they encountered when they applied for a grant but were turned down until they could find an Indigenous partner to receive the grant on their behalf because Ottawa First is not an Indigenous organization. And while it sounds like they welcome the opportunity to create strong partnerships with Indigenous organizations, it means that the Ajashki project may need to consider how to set up their organizational structure in relation to their main sponsoring organization, Ottawa First.
To be within the system in this case means navigating legal structures and frameworks in order to access the various grants, while simultaneously managing the relationship between Indigenous groups and settler groups. I've had this experience applying for grants to produce documentaries with First Nations and Inuit communities. There's always an underlying power dynamic that can add pressure to the relationship.
The other part to unpack is the role that charity, foundations, and grants play within the larger colonial system. Ajashki and other community-based ministries rely on grants or volunteers, which means their existence is dependent on the whim of donors, and so they need to cater their actions to suit donor goals and priorities. And it means they could cease to exist if donors decide that they no longer are going to fund them. I shared my thoughts about grants and colonialism perpetuating old systems of oppression. Charities mean that somebody who has stuff gets to gift it to people who they perceive don't have stuff. And then that perpetuates the problem, right? And charities exist when the colonial system has such huge gaps. And the gaps exist because it's set up to favor certain people. And then the balance is supposed to be it's favored to reward these sort of people. And then those that have lots give money and get a tax donation. But it's set up so that those people are always in that position of needing. And so when we talk about decolonial work and using social enterprise, what we're trying to do is remind people that the things that they have previously said don't have value really do have value. And we want people to have experiences where they can see that something that they've made isn't just being, say, purchased out of pity. When I talk to people who perceive themselves to be lacking, that are on the recipient side of charity, I always love to say to them, in what ways are you selling yourself out? In what ways are you not seeing your own worth? And then folks who believe themselves to have something and then are then worthy to decide whether a project begins or ends or whatever based on whether they decide to give money. And you start going down that path where from an energetic perspective, you're focusing on the things you don't want to see more of in order to get the funding. You're saying, here's the pathetic state we're in. People with power and privilege decide right now, you know, do you want to keep us in our misery or do you want us to move forward, right? To me, that's like, oh my gosh, same old colonial drama and trauma going on over again, right? So you have this really beautiful opportunity, in my opinion, with the tango between this religious organization, but that is becoming more conscious of the colonial dynamic. And then folks like yourself who are willing to work in, you know, some sort of a collaborative way, but to actually begin to push back on some of these default settings that are so ingrained in how we think of doing these sort of projects. How I see it is that money is energy, and like all energy, it wants to flow freely and it wants to gain speed and momentum and, you know, move towards abundance, not, you know, scarcity. And so when we create opportunities for what people have to be authentically acknowledged, it doesn't mean that money has to be the only thing, but it is the way that our societies often work. When things are honored as being truly meaningful, it actually changes mindset.
This certainly puts the idea of charity into a different light. So often we think about it from the perspective of being the ones to give to those in need. It feels good to help people out, so we could understandably begin to conclude that charity is a good thing because it feels good to be the giver. But we may not think about the impacts it may have to those in the position of recipient. Grants may temporarily relieve discomfort, or in the case of Ajashki, pay wages to Indigenous participants, but that only lasts as long as the grant, and then things go back to the way they were.
Yeah, so grants offer a temporary change, but not always a permanent solution.
So what can we be doing that is more sustainable?
Well, one thing is to begin challenging some of our beliefs, assumptions, and resistance to models of operating that include components of business. For instance, at one point in my conversation with UniCamp, one of them referred to people who attend as customers and then changed it to community members. My sense is that they're wanting to emphasize that people are being invited into a community, which makes sense. However, it's almost like the word customer was being seen as sort of like a dirty word.
Right, because that might feel too transactional. But the reality is that people are paying Unicamp to have a certain type of experience or facility, and that is a customer service provider relationship.
Right. And if there is a hesitancy to engage with the aspect of the relationship that is customer service provider, it can create a block in terms of understanding potential paths forward to build a thriving community, which is a value they're upholding. For instance, Unicamp, who we introduced in the last episode, has a vision for itself that requires more money. Aside from general maintenance, repairs, and retaining their quality staff, they see themselves as the go-to campsite for many people from all walks of life. Here's Yvette Salinas, Executive Director of Unicamp.
My big dream is like to have more glampingy things. Joanna and I have talked about having canvas tents available so people can walk in, have a tent ready to go. That would be so amazing. But the cost of maintaining our current cottages and our dorms that, God help them, they're old. They're trying. It's so expensive that getting to that next level, it's difficult.
Do they know how to determine if and when it's the right time to build a business and how to do so sustainably?
This is an area where they expressed that they could use some additional support. I asked about the skills of the people on the board and if there were people there that can help them with the business strategy. Here's Yvette Salina's reply.
Our nominating committee is pretty good about going out and finding people that have some experience and understanding, but I would be remiss to say, like, this is what congregations are going through as well. You get the board members you get. You're happy if you fill your board, right? Because some years you're just struggling to fill those seats because you legally have to fill those seats. People aren't knocking on our doors.
Okay, so by the sounds of it, they do not have the business knowledge themselves, nor do their board members. So this must make things very challenging.
I think it does. And I shared with them that some not-for-profit boards will operate as a mastermind team of sorts, where there are specific people on the board with the skills to advise those running social enterprises like Unicamp about how to make business plans, when and how to scale up their business, and how to approach things like securing finances and marketing the new venture. Ideally, this group can take the guesswork out of things. And of course, there is the option of paying a professional consultant to map out a path forward that the staff and board could roll out. Joanna Barrington, camp director, noted there's always a cost to these things.
It's true, it could cost money, but if it's done wisely, it would be an investment into a prosperous future.
Right. And there is a difference between spending money that you don't get back and investing money that brings a return on investment. So for a social enterprise, that return is not just financial, but includes the enhancement of the cause. While there was a desire for help, I heard an overall concern about not having the money to access the type of support they need. Here's an excerpt of our conversation about this.
If we could have a professional consultant come in and be like, hey, like, this is what you could do better, or this little move will help you in this little way, that would be super cool. It's beyond our budget right now. We're doing what we can to access the resources we can. Joe's mentioning the Ontario Camp Association. It's worth the price at least to have her in that, because then she has access to resources. But a lot of the board resources and my own professional development, it's what we can access online for free. We can't get to that level yet because that requires income that we don't have.
And it's always a balance, right? Because back to talking about customers, right? That people are still paying money and you have to look at what they are paying for. Have you tried raising your rates?
We have to raise them if we want to at least cover the cost of staffing and maintaining the space. But then the big question is, will the campers still keep coming? Which is why we try to create funds so that if people can't afford it, they can at least request some subsidies. We've prided ourselves because we're pretty affordable compared to other summer camps like that, but we still have to raise our fees so that we can pay our staff members properly. I don't feel like we could go to our camper parents and be like, hey, can you give us $700 for a week of kids camp instead of $538? That amount of jump, I think it would impact our families too much. But are we needing to get to that point just so we can feed the kids properly? Food costs are just so incredible from this past year. We're doing what we can to make ends meet.
This operation would benefit greatly from some coaching on how to find that healthy balance in charging enough money so they can provide a quality experience.
I agree. Now, both Joanna and Yvette are concerned that if they go too high, some families may not be able to afford to pay for camp. But on the other hand, some families won't send their kids to this camp unless it's a better camp. In this next conversation, Joanna and I speak about the hesitancy to discuss UniCamp in business terms and the challenge it places on them as employers when they don't have the money needed to pay employees well or have enough employees to ensure staff satisfaction remains high. You said before, Joanna, about our customers, and I don't think that's a terrible word. I think that's fine to think about an exchange of money that happens. It's an energy, and it's not an evil thing to have going well through a place so that people can feel like whatever they're contributing is the right amount for what they're getting back. It's a heck of a lot better than people feeling the burnout, the resentment. I can hear you saying that you're trying to have a blend of professionalism and community feel.
Yes, we're trying to maintain ourselves and make sure we're giving proper employment opportunities to youth. So we need to charge a good rate to our customers, or I also like to call them guests. It sounds nicer. I don't know why I said customers, but it is. There is an exchange of money, and that's how we keep the camp going. But it's also that funny balance between that and, yes, it's a community that we want to keep meeting amazing people and giving this opportunity to so many people to enjoy. So yeah, definitely a funny balance.
For the last half of my conversation with Yvette and Joanna, I took off my researcher hat and put on my social entrepreneur hat. Some listeners may not know this, but since 2006, I've operated a not-for-profit that is a social enterprise, and we've created other social enterprises within that model. It's also a topic that I did my doctoral studies on, so it's more than just an interest that I have. And since Joanna and Yvette were so clearly motivated and eager and devoted to their mission, we had a bit of fun discussing potential paths forward.
I'm wearing a slightly different hat, but as I hear you speak, I hear so many interesting little emerging nuggets where you're saying we really are this safe community and this haven for queer, polyamorous, trans, whatever kind of folks. And that becomes something that's different to market than just we're a kids camp or we're a kids camp with UU values. It's saying, here's what UU values look like when you bring them into reality, which to me is a very different thing than talking about UU values. It's showing UU values. Yeah. And so when you tell that story well, and if you had marketing support, you can be kind of like, you know, when you said you're working with the Ontario Campers Association, there's this sense of we're on a journey together, not that you have to arrive in order to be even considered. But what I think about then is telling that story well, because what you want is for people to say, first of all, I will pay more to have my kids go to the camp because I see the vision and I'm willing to put in more because I want to be able to build and grow, not just to have the bare minimum experience. But they typically, with customers, they need to be seeing what they're paying for and then they need to feel compelled for whatever comes next. So as I'm talking to you right now, I'm in my co-working center and that's one of my businesses. And so I'm always going through this process of here's what we have to offer and trying to keep it as affordable as possible because of our social mission. But on the same note, we have costs and they continue to go up. We cannot tend to those and then you'll just see a crappier and crappier experience. We tell them here's the cost of maintaining the experience you're having, the real cost, the true cost, the not subsidized cost. And then here's what it would be like if they say, but we want to have like a recording studio so that we don't have to drive to the city to make our whatever we do. Then we're like, okay, then there's the cost of this, the true cost. What I've been amazed with, not just for this, but like I've done lots of different projects like this, is that people often will pay you more than you think they would. With social valued organizations, we tend to undermine what we have to offer. And we think, oh my gosh, we might alienate a poor family or something. But we, in doing that, we almost service down to the point then that you don't get the families who would send their kids if it was serviced up.
That's awesome.
There's lots to be said about this. I helped a camp. They used to be a thriving camp. So I've seen that balance of always trying to figure out how you move forward, but you can't move forward without telling customers why. And for social driven organizations, they want to be a part of that why. So I'm inspired when I hear you talk, because I can see things in what you're saying that are easy to market to certain crowds, but you do have to have the support to know how to tell the story and to market. And then you do have to figure out, you know, the base stuff so that you're not having whatever. I don't even know. I haven't been to UniCamp in a long time, but whatever it is that you say is not the way you wish it was because the dampness is causing the wood to break or, you know, just whatever it is. It's a lot easier to move towards that. And when you're talking about things like you said, well, why doesn't the CUC use that facility for for? That's a wonderful question to be asking, because that would be looking at people as customers and saying, I want your business. What do you need?
Yeah.
What would make this a destination for you? Because you know that you have the potential there. This is why several times you've heard me say the word customers over and over again, because I want you to hear from me that I think that's brilliant to be thinking that way. Nothing wrong with that, because it's not exploitive to say to somebody, we want to treat you well. We want to help you. We want you to feel at home in our space.
Sounds like a really great conversation, and potentially points to the type of business coaching that could help UniCamp take their next steps.
Yes, it's exciting to imagine where they could take their vision with just a little bit of strategic support. I had a similar conversation with Ajashki and was thrilled to hear that they're in the first steps of thinking about social enterprise opportunities. Here's Keoki again, followed by Lynn.
We created a makerspace at Ajashki. So we got another room where we're building stuff that we could use to sell, make a bit of money on the side for Ajashki. And it's all centered around, like, today we were making decorative holiday baskets, conifers and pine cones and stuff like that. It kind of has to do with gardening. So it kind of has to do with what we're working with. It's also teaching them a skill that, like, hey, you know, it's not just here you can make it. You can also go home and build this kind of thing and sell it yourself as well.
A lot of the ideas that what we're going to go forward with have already been generated by the Future Food Warriors. So we sat down and we said, what skills do you have? What skills would you like to share? And we came up with a lot of things with that they already know that they'd like to participate in. But then they had questions about things they don't know how to do that they would like to learn how to do.
Yeah,
and
the knitting,
they all want to knit, for instance. And so how do we use that then to create something that might be marketable for them and for us?
I shared a few thoughts to help them expand their scope of the types of things that they could sell. Here are some excerpts from that conversation that show how ideas began flowing even in the short span of our conversation, as we considered all the various things Ajashki is uniquely positioned to share with others.
Is two tiers of things you could sell, things you make with your hands, and then things that are learning or heart-centered. Those are all things that are sellable.
As you were talking about selling the knowledge about climate change and food security and mental wellness, I also think there might be a place for the youth who come to us with certain skills that they've learned either in their community or in their family to be able to hold workshops that might actually be physically, I think people here kind of like the hands-on stuff too, so that they could also be running those workshops. It doesn't have to be the Circle of Support or Keoki. I think the youth could also be involved in what they've learned either hands-on or through the program.
Building on Lynn's comment about youth being involved as teachers, I offered this idea of how to create scenarios that are a win for Ajashki, a win for the youth, and a win for the person or people that are engaging with the project.
Helping people to understand how to tell their story, mm-hmm. whatever their story is, but not in an exploitive way, but in an educational way, for people to learn how to share their story of their involvement in this project, but from a place of weaving in the climate and the language and the culture and what things mean and how things got to be where they are. So now they're becoming advocates for their own project, but without buying into that plot line that says, I'm the youth that's being rescued or helped because of this initiative. Because I love that you use that term warriors. That term is suggesting not pitiful recipients. It's the opposite of that. So then it's like embodying that and helping them to share their story in a way that has meaningful impact. There's very ethical ways to be able to weave that into your storytelling, because lots of times in communities like Ottawa, there'll be people saying, we would love to have someone come and give a 10-minute talk or a 15-minute talk. And now suddenly you say, no problem, we'll do that talk for 10 minutes. It costs $200, $300. The Ajashki keeps this much and we give this much to the youth. And it's like a $100 talk for 10 minutes. And they're like, sign me up. I'll get real good. Right? So that's, I guess, what I mean by when you find win-win-wins. It's a win for the person developing their skills and it's a win for the organization.
I love the idea of finding exchanges that are a three ways win.
Me too. And that really is at the heart of social enterprise. It's not meant to be exploitive. It's not about someone having power over someone else, but about sharing power. The idea is to create exchanges that are life-giving to all involved while creating a model that allows the vision of the project to continue in a way that is sustainable.
So it really is about harnessing the vehicle of entrepreneurship and putting it into the service of a good cause.
Exactly. On the topic of power, I want to share an excerpt of a conversation I had with Liz James of Mirth and Dignity, where they approach the power dynamic of money very differently. While they function through a combination of volunteer labor and donations, they intentionally limit how much people can give. Here's Liz to explain more.
Very intentional about soliciting small donations from large groups of people. So we don't have anyone that donates more than $25 a month is our top tier. And that's because that gives us a certain kind of freedom to not have big donors that we depend on, because it means that we're very flexible in terms of our direction. It also makes us economically accessible and diverse in a way that we really like.
Okay, so to put it in another way, having a big sponsor could make it so that you have to do what the sponsor wants you to do in order to get the sponsor.
Yeah, and in a sense, we do have the grant body, but we have a really good relationship with them, and that's a body of people. It makes sense to be accountable to a group, but we don't want to be accountable to individuals.
This is a very important part of what we've been trying to figure out when it comes to the changing of structures when you do have, I would say, a financial vulnerability. So you have groups of people who cannot exist without a few very wealthy donors, but then you do risk the loss of autonomy, right? Because people can just be, for lack of a better word, can just bully their way into whatever they want. Because if you don't do what they want, then they'll just say, we're not donating.
When if you're trying to be diverse, the way systems of privilege work, the people who are big donors tend to be people with a lot of privilege. That's how they got money in the first place. Not always, but there's a tendency that way. And so if you as an organization want to really dig into diversity, it's very hard to do that if your finances are tied up in people who all come from one cultural group. So that gives us an ability to be more flexible in what we choose to do.
I love that consciousness behind that choice. Like, I love that that was intentional and designed to think about power and think about the inclusivity and diversity.
What important points here? So often we get caught up in worries about not having enough money, whether it's in our community ministry or a congregational ministry, that we don't think about the strings that are attached to the money that comes our way.
And so whether it's through small donations from a large group of people, as Liz described, or a large number of customers supporting a social enterprise through paying for ethical goods and services, there is a freedom in not relying on a large sponsor. It allows the ministry to march to its own drum.
We've been told the need to keep key financial supporters happy has skewed power dynamics within some UU congregations. Some UUs have expressed that they feel like they are less valued members if they can't help to pay the bills. And then conversely, those that can are seen as more valuable. On more than one occasion, we have heard anecdotes of there being decisions that need to be made within the congregation, and those with money saying they will leave if they don't get the outcome they want. Without that financial donation, the UU congregation would not be able to keep up with the cost of the building or staff, and so people relent in order to not fall out of the favor of these big donors.
Money can also get tied up in things that are not necessarily in service to the vision or needs of the community. In episode 5, we heard from folks who do not have a building, and some of that reasoning was because of the expense.
Right. We heard that if we're not careful, it's possible to view people's value in terms of their ability to pitch in financially to maintain this resource, especially when the costs of sustaining it become all-consuming, meaning if they can't contribute financially, they are worth less in some way. Some people have said they feel like they're being juiced for money because, for instance, their roof needs being done or the furnace is in need of repair.
And these decisions that need to be made around a building, in a way, bring things like classism, ableism, racism, ageism into UU spaces in a very real way that becomes much more apparent than it may be if there wasn't the pressing need to figure out how to keep a building sustainable. The idea that I'm thinking about is this a tough balance, right? Because on one hand, we can't ignore the fact that we need money in order to maintain these things, but we cannot make it the center of the mission and the goal of whatever it is we're doing together. It has to be managed with consciousness and transparency when it comes to power, but also recognizing what the limitations are. That if you have a resource and you cannot keep it up and nobody present can do that, then putting the community in service to and in debt to upkeep this resource may not be in the best interest of the growth of that UU community.
Yes.
I Another area where money emerged as a topic is in my conversations with UU young adults. Money was recognized as a very sensitive topic, as several young adults have expressed that their own financial life is precarious.
It's true. They live in an economy where part-time work and hustling is commonplace, and the cost of housing has made home rentership out of reach for many, never mind home ownership.
Yeah, so there's an apprehension to ask for money when it comes to their UU ministries. One example came up during my interview with the organizers of Queer Connecting after we were talking about their ideal situation of having money to remunerate facilitators and the option to invite queer ministers to be involved in some capacity. I inquired how this could be funded. Now, since they requested anonymity, I'll just share what I heard. So they see Queer Connecting as a free group, and that if other UUs want to contribute to, say, minister time, they're not opposed to that. They would even be open to some sort of acknowledgement of the sponsorship and invitation to donate to the CUC. But they felt that suggesting an amount to participate could make it really awkward.
I hear their desire is to keep this group relational and not have it feel like something people have to pay to play, so to speak. Of course, the challenge here is that too is not sustainable long term unless the group is okay with truly being peer-led and volunteer-based and can manage the minimal cost of hosting the online platform that allows them to meet there as opposed to in person.
I got the impression in talking with the various young adults I met through these interviews that they may not yet be aware that the model that has funded the Canadian Unitarian Council, which has financially supported young adult programming staff and related activities, is no longer sustaining itself because congregations are shrinking in size. And so then is the money they give to support young adult programming.
And since these young adults are not necessarily becoming members of congregations, then the number of people contributing to the funds the CUC receives is also decreasing. This really needs to be examined openly by all demographics of UUs.
I wholeheartedly agree. And while it is certainly okay for things to change over time, with certain things starting while other things end, it might be beneficial to get everyone involved in understanding the situation so conscious planning and decision-making can happen and other approaches can be employed to ensure financial sustainability.
To wrap up this episode about money, can we talk about the theological perspective of money? You've noted several times through these interviews that some UUs have apprehension, fear, caution, resistance, and like negative views of money.
Absolutely. And I asked the Congregational Life team about this exact thing when I shared with them what I was hearing. I wondered if some of the views people express may have connections to Bible verses that have very strong cautions in regards to money, such as Matthew 19:23-26 that reads, "And Jesus said unto his disciples, Verily I say unto you, it's hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. And again, I say unto you, it is easier for a camel to go through a needle's eye than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God." So here's Reverend Linda Thompson's reflections.
Scripture about money actually says the love of money is the root of all evil, not money. Money is a tool that we use in our culture. Everyone's got exchanges that happen. So I think there's a lot of education and thinking around that.
That feels like an important distinction. Loving money and putting the need for it above the intent to build beloved community. That's where she's saying things can get off track. But money itself is not evil.
Exactly. And Linda gave an example of how she and Reverend Ann Barker are witnessing this happening in the ways that some congregations are approaching the decline in membership and therefore financial resources.
And you talked about scarcity and how it made people anxious, Erin. And I think that feels fundamental to the social enterprise question for me, because there are a lot of congregations who are feeling in peril, vulnerable right now. Like if we don't get more money, if we don't get more people, it's all going to fall apart. So they're at this level of real fear. So when they imagine themselves being in the community, they imagine it's a recruiting project. So they're coming at the, we want to talk to people out in the larger community because we want them to serve us. And that is completely upside down and backwards. The reason we need to go out into the community is because we want to live our values and we want to express them in the world.
Right. So you can see how the focus isn't on serving the people, but on finding people who value the congregational experience enough to become funders of it.
Interestingly, there are others who take the opposite approach and seem to distance themselves from money, which seems to be motivated in genuine concern about excluding people who can't afford to pay, which tracks with the UU history of advocating for the poor. This is an approach that works fine as long as there's enough wealthier people who want to contribute to the upkeep of a building, minister, staff, and the projects of the church.
Which we are learning is not the case currently within UUism.
And it makes it even more timely to consider our theological perspective on how to use money as a tool to serve others and bring UU values into the world. Here's Linda again.
We need to figure out how to be creative to attach value to that in a way that helps sustain fair wages for people.
And by wages, she's referring to the potential of creating good jobs for people.
Yes, and something that would likely be welcomed by young adults who have expressed a need for good, stable employment alongside a desire to contribute to things that have a direct and meaningful impact.
This isn't to say that congregations don't have a meaningful impact on those who enjoy their expression, but we know that this is not the only way of expressing UU values in the world.
And if a UU community is able to bring to life a social enterprise idea that brings them joy and has value to the general public, there's the opportunity to build community, engage new people, share UU values, create good employment, and bring in money that is separate from people's participation in UU communities and ceremony.
And like Linda said, it will take some creativity.
And some new skills. As we have seen in this episode, passion only gets a social enterprise part of the way there. There are essential skills that transform a great idea into a thriving social enterprise.
And I get a sense from hearing about the community-based ministries that are happening already that serving the world in the ways that already bring us passion and joy could open another way of thinking about all of this.
Now, on that note, I'd like to end this episode on money by sharing an excerpt of a conversation between myself and Liz James of the Hysterical Society, whose online humor ministry engages over 200,000 people.
What you said at the beginning is that the Hysterical Society happened because you value laughing.
Yeah.
That's even a little bit more different, right? It's not you looking out into the world and saying, oh, this very horrible world is so blah, it needs to laugh. I'm going to make it laugh. And gosh darn it, you're going to do that laughing for, I think you need it. That is,
yeah.
You know, some of what happens when people impose. And then there's the other thing, which is the business model where people will say, whether people need it or not, we'll make them think they need it so that they'll buy the thing, which is also exploitive. So it really is about what brings us to life, what makes our hearts shine. And then with vulnerability, sharing whatever that is.
I think the thing that you're talking about, how do we meet people where they are, is so crucial. Many people who fund the UU Hysterical Society don't ever become UU. They're UU-ish. They're UU adjacent. They're sort of like you are. And we had this aha moment when we realized we aren't using humor to serve Unitarian Universalism. We are using Unitarian Universalism as a tool to achieve the ends of humor and community. And so I love the way you're thinking because it opens us up to, it's not our job to make a pocket of Unitarians from which we collect APC and that's how we survive. It's our job to take Unitarianism and just make it useful. Add value, and then you can collect money whenever you add value.
It's our job to take Unitarianism and make it useful, add value, and then collect money wherever you add value. This is such great wealth of knowledge. It's very inspiring.
I agree. I love it. In our next episode, we'll delve more into the potential that exists in social enterprise models for community-based ministry. I look forward to wrapping up my conversation with these ambitious UU expressions and share some of the potential ideas that came out of our conversations about next steps.
Until we meet again.